description of her team, their qualifications, and their methods.
What is your assessment in particular of Dr. Safadi's abilities, then, Dr. Bekri?
The camera shifted to Dernium. She looked as if the question made no sense.
Dr. Safadi is one of the best scientists I have worked with. She's meticulous, scrupulous, and very well informed.
Safadi, listening, smiled quietly to herself. It was good to know that people had her back. At last, Dernium was released, and Safadi was called. They passed each other as Safadi was brought in, and Dernium gave her a quick hug.
"Be brilliant, Amal," she said, "like you always are."
Still, Safadi thought, as she took her seat in front of the committee, it was hard not to feel anxious, and hard not to feel faintly as if she were on trial. The committee, seven of them in total, sat in a semicircle in front of her. Safadi sat alone at a desk facing them. She placed her pad down. It was good to have notes to refer to in case of nerves or surprises, although she was confident that she could speak without them. A fair-haired woman about Safadi's age was sitting in the middle of the semicircle. Safadi recognized her immediately.
"Dr. Safadi, I'm Olivia Quest, junior counselor for Estolin and chair of this committee. Do you give permission for this interview to be recorded?"
"Of course, counselor."
"Thank you, Dr. Safadi. If we could begin with you giving an overview of the study you carried out that revised your understanding of the impact of the Romulan supernova?"
Safadi tried to relax. She knew this material well, and she had presented versions of it to all kinds of audiences, to experts and peers, to newscasts, to local science groups that had invited her to speak. She knew that Quest had a scientific background, as did one or two of the other committee members, but not all of them did. So she pitched it relatively low. If they wanted details of the math, they could open their computers and look at the equations. It was not like she was keeping them hidden. Her presentation went smoothly enough. There were one or two queries, which she answered clearly and crisply. When she was done, she waited for the next salvo. Quest, she noticed, had been sitting with her head down throughout, taking copious notes. At last, the counselor looked up, pinning Safadi with her bright blue gaze.
"I have one question. Dr. Safadi, the math behind this is very complicated. Do you think it is possible that you could have made a mistake?"
"Counselor Quest, everything is possible. Could I have made a mistake? Yes. Do I think it likely that I made a mistake? No."
"So, if you think you made a mistake, you're misrepresenting what I said. If you think a mistake is possible, unlikely, but possible, yes, those are your own words?"
"My words are possible, but unlike—"
Quest stopped her.
"If you think your model is possibly flawed, why are you pushing it?"
"Because given the evidence, it's the most likely scenario."
"But that's precisely what academician Vertet says is not the case, isn't it? Dr. Safadi, isn't science about consensus?"
"The consensus among me and other colleagues is that the threat from the supernova is considerably greater than the official Romulan figures."
"Don't you think that's rather extreme?" said Quest. "Almost apocalyptic? Why push this particular reading of the data? Why not something more balanced?"
Safadi took a deep breath.
"Counselor Quest, I am not writing science fiction. I am interpreting data. If that data signals an apocalypse, it's my duty to report that accurately. It's up to people like you to decide what action to take to mitigate the effects."
"But don't you think this is all very Cassandra-like?"
"Cassandra," said Safadi, "was telling the truth. The problem was that nobody listened."
There was a small ripple of laughter. Quest covered her displeasure.
"But Dr. Vertet says something different."
"I want to be absolutely clear about one thing," said Safadi. "I greatly respect Nokim Vertet and his work, but this report cannot be true. Whether he is working from incomplete data or whether scientists on Romulus are being censored, I know for a fact that the figures presented in the report sent to me under his name are not and cannot be true.
There was a short silence. Those are some pretty strong accusations, Dr. Safadi, said Quest. Are you saying the Romulans are lying to us?
I have no idea, Safadi said. None whatsoever.
There are political ramifications to a statement like that.
Councillor Quest, I leave politics to the politicians. But we must be very clear. Math is math. Let me remind you what a great scientist once said when asked to make mathematics bend to the wishes of politicians. Nature cannot be fooled.
Around her there was a great stir. Quest looked uncomfortable.
My job, said Safadi, is to tell you as clearly as possible what my observations of nature are telling me. I've told you that, Councillor Quest. Now you must decide what you want to do with that information.
One of the other committee members leaned in to whisper something to Quest, who then said,
Thank you, Dr. Safadi. You've been very helpful.
Hey, Mama, thought Safadi as she made her way out into the corridor. I hope you were watching.
Haig was waiting, arms folded, back against the wall.
Well done, he said.
Thank you.
You said everything that needed to be said, and no more.
She considered this.
You know, she said, there's something that still worries me.
Oh, yes?
He pushed himself up from the wall and began to walk toward the exit. She followed him.
What's happening to the Romulan star? I don't have an explanation for it. Correction. I don't have a natural explanation for it.
No?
I think it was made, created, not naturally occurring.
Do you?
What does Starfleet think? She said.
They reached the exit. He grasped for the handle, but did not open it.
I think that you don't have any evidence, Dr. Safadi. It's just a feeling, and you should put it out of your mind.
He gave her a wan smile.
Stick to science. Leave the politics to us.
He opened the door. Dernium was standing outside. She took Safadi by the arm and hurried her past the waiting journalists.
Come quickly and quietly, she muttered in Safadi's ear. Where are you taking me? Said Safadi. For cocktails. You've earned them, Amal.
Safadi let herself be led away. But back at her quiet home that night, watching the blackbird on the fence, she pondered what Haig had said and tried to persuade herself that he was right.
If I could visit Romulus, she thought, get close to their son, make sure.
But that was never going to happen. And besides, she had other worries. Shivering, she remembered the cold gleam of anger she had seen in Quest's eyes, and she wondered if she had made a mistake, or even an enemy.
Nimbus 3.
We shall not go.
Rafi, tired, her eyes full of dust, looked at the woman opposite and tried to sympathize. Delike Hur was a small, thin, tough Romulan who had a long white scar running down her forearm. Rafi suspected that Hur was not as old as she looked, not surprising, given the life she must have led on this benighted world. Nimbus was a desert, and until 10 or 12 years ago, despite being nominally ceded to Romulan control, had been without any effective government. It had also been plagued by the worst kind of mercenaries.
Imagine trying to scratch a living out of this dump, Rafi thought.
Imagine trying to build something, always living in terror that it would be taken by force, that someone would kill you, simply because they could. Some people harbored their survivalist fantasies. They snuck off into the wild to have the excuse to live out some vision of themselves as all-powerful, inviolable. The people of Nimbus 3 had seen them off. They triumphed in the end. Now, they didn't want to leave their world behind.
I understand the reasons for your resistance, Picard began.
Her cut him off.
No, she said,
You do not. You cannot. We have built a home here. We will not have it taken away.
Rafi glanced at Jael. He was nodding at her as she spoke, and listening, too, listening closely, as if he believed that if he was attentive enough, he would somehow find the key to unlock her, the means by which she would be persuaded to think his way. But he wouldn't. There was no key to unlock this woman. There was no argument that would make her see the light. Hur's attachment to this place was emotional, not rational. Staying here was not rational. Therefore, she could not be reasoned out of this.
"Do you understand," Picard said, "that this world is at risk? You will surely feel an impact from the supernova. As the situation worsens on Romulus, whatever support you get will disappear completely. It will become harder and harder to survive here."
Hur laughed, a rasp that ended up in a coughing fit. A young woman sitting next to her put her hand upon Hur's arm and passed her some water. Hur drank sparingly, enough to help with the cough, but not more, and set the cup down again with reverence.
Water. There mustn't be much of it here. They had certainly not been offered any.
"Hard to survive," Hur said. "You're describing Nimbus as it is right now."
"Hard to survive."
She looked at him in scorn.
"If you want to help, give us some replicators. Then go away and leave us alone."
"Madam," said Picard, addressing her as if she were an ambassador from a huge and wealthy alien power.
To give Jael credit, Rafi thought, he always speaks this way. He does not discriminate between the great and good and the small and not so good.
"Eventually you will run out of resources. If you remain here, you are going to die."
"Never thought I'd make it in the first place," said Hura. "I've seen famine, plague, watched crops burn for no better reason than to amuse some warlord or other. Yet here I am. We got through before. We'll get through this."
"Madam."
"The simple fact is," said Hur, "that I don't believe you, Mr. Starfleet." "Why should I? The people who settled here all those years ago? Starfleet was meant to protect them, promised to protect them. But at the first sign of trouble, they were gone. The planet of galactic peace. My ancestors were left to die. But they didn't die. They didn't die. They got through. And they told us, never trust Starfleet, because they're liars."
She looked at him as if he were dirt on her shoe.
"Why should I believe you, Mr. Starfleet?"
For a moment, Rafi thought Jael was going to make the mistake of trying to explain to this woman why Starfleet had pulled out of the Nimbus project. It would only make matters worse. A Starfleet admiral lecturing this woman about her own history. But Jael, fortunately, had good sense. He glanced at Coley, inviting her to speak. Rafi had been surprised when Coley had announced that she would not be wearing her uniform for this mission. She could see the wisdom in it now. Instead of speaking for Starfleet, Coley was speaking as a Bajoran. It brought credibility to her words. Bajorans, too, had been caught between great powers. They had had their world taken from them, and they had struggled to rebuild. And they had accepted Starfleet's help. Rafi hoped this would be enough.
"Madam Hura," said Coley, "there is no reason for you to trust us. There is every reason to suspect that we have come to take this world from you by deception."
Rafi saw Hura flinch. "Yes, clever Coley. That was what was going on, wasn't it? The locals suspected some trick, some ploy to get them off-planet. They must think that the world had, in some way, acquired sudden value. New mineral deposits under the ground, a strategic advantage in the changing galactic order following the breach of the neutral zone. Whatever it was, the people of Nimbus wanted their share."
"All that I can say to you," Coley went on, "is that is not the case. what we showed you is true. Your way of life is under threat from the blast range of a supernova that will destroy the Romulan homeworld. There is no fairness to this, no justice. If there was, you would live out your days in peace on the land that you have fought so hard for. But that cannot happen. Madame Hura, it's not fair. The Romulan sun is going supernova, and you will be left to fend for yourselves. We are here to offer you safe passage. Please, choose to live, thought Rafi suddenly.
Coley held out her hands.
Please, let us help.
Hura had been looking at Coley carefully throughout this speech. When the Bajoran finished, the older woman took another sip of water, licked her lips, and looked around at her three visitors. Her eyes narrowed as she saw the Starfleet uniforms. Then she clenched her teeth. How this conversation might have ended, Rafi would never know. At the time, only a few weeks after Vashti, she had believed that Hura was about to concede, allow them to help. She would call for water to be given to them and shared around. They would eat together. They always ended up eating together on these worlds, once the agreement had been made, the universal gesture of friendship. And they would begin their plans to evacuate the world. That was what Rafi imagined at the time. Later, she was not so sure. Had that last sip been one of resolution? The prelude to a refusal? A rejection? A response based on suspicion and mistrust? Later on, Rafi would find it hard not to think that was what it had been. Either way, she was not allowed to find out. Suddenly, the door swung open, and a young man ran in. He was clutching a rifle. Rafi jumped to her feet, put herself between him and Picard. Later, Rafi had a lot of time on her hands later, a lot of time to go through all her steps and missteps. She wondered whether that might in itself have finished off any chance of trust between them and the people of Nimbus. The assumption on her part that any interruption presaged some attempt on their lives. But the young man was not looking at them. Breathlessly, he said to Hura,
Tal'Shiar, they're here!
Hura stared at him, and then at Picard.
Did you bring them here?
And Rafi, watching Jael's jaw harden, thought,
Not us. Tajuth.
The chief settlement on Nimbus 3 was a collection of low buildings huddled around a red dirt square. Rafi, ducking her head to pass under the low door, looked out to see a crowd of around 24 people gathered outside. Some had their hands held high or placed on top of their heads. Looking beyond these, she saw 12 black-clad figures armed with disruptors. Tal'Shiar.
Shit,
she said, and gestured to Picard to stay inside. From behind her, she heard his comm badge chime and Lieutenant Marshall's voice come through.
Admiral Picard, I have Admiral Bordson on a priority channel here. He wants to speak to you immediately.
Rafi came back inside. Picard had turned to her.
Madam, that is the Commander-in-Chief of Starfleet. May I take the message in your office? I am sure he is advising how we may help.
Her pointed at the desk over on one side of the room. An office was overstating it, Rafi thought.
Typical JL, bestowing dignity where there was none.
Picard took a seat behind the desk and turned on the beaten-up old comm. Her, despite the protestations of the young woman with her, went outside. Coley followed them. Rafi, at the door, said,
JL, shall I go?
Stay here, but out of sight, he said, and close the door.
A chill went down Rafi's spine. She realized suddenly, looking at his grim expression, he wasn't expecting help. He was expecting to be told to stand aside.
Victor? Jean-Luc? Who called them in?
I don't know, but the Romulan ambassador informed us about an hour ago that they were sending their own people to Nimbus,
and that they would oversee the relocation effort from now on.
Why? Why here? There's nothing here.
Who knows, Jean-Luc? Maybe they're angry about Dr. Safadi's appearance before the committee. Maybe they want to punish the locals for disobedience. Maybe there are secret bases on Nimbus that none of us know anything about, and they don't want Starfleet there.
Or maybe, thought Rafi, Tajuth was paying them back for Inkstus. From outside there came a shout, and then a burst of disruptor fire, short and quickly over.
Mother effers, muttered Rafi.
She pulled out her phaser, opened the door a crack, and peered out into the square beyond. Everything was deadly quiet. From behind her, she heard the voices of the two admirals.
Victor, they are firing weapons.
Admiral Picard, you have your orders. You must not intervene. Return to your ship at once. Starfleet Command out.
Rafi looked out. Coley was kneeling over someone, trying to save their life. Her was standing beside her, weeping openly. Rafi, looking at the body on the ground, recognized him as the young man who had come to tell them that the Tal Shiar were here. Who was he? Her's son? Grandson? Someone significant.
Rafi, Picard called out. What is going on out there?
Bad things, JL. But nobody's shooting right now.
Put the phaser away. We'll go out. Try to talk to them.
JL, I don't think that's a bright idea.
You heard Bordson. We have no jurisdiction here. Let's not make this worse, Rafi.
Bitterly, she put away the phaser. Picard stood up, straightened his uniform, and gathered himself. She followed him out into the square. She counted 5 Romulan weapons immediately turned their way. Picard lifted his hands, a gesture of peace, but by no means surrender.
There is no need for this, he said.
One of the Tal Shiar holstered his weapon and came toward them.
Are you Picard?
I am Admiral Picard, yes.
You and your people can leave now.
Coley was still trying to breathe life into the young man. Picard looked toward her.
Not yet, he said.
They watched in agonized silence for what could surely have been no more than a minute. At last it became plain to everyone there that the young man was dead. Rafi wanted to go over to her colleague, help her, put her hand upon her shoulder.
No chance.
Jokan, she said, it's over. You've done all you can.
Coley sat up. She reached over and closed the young man's eyes. She sat back on her heels. Her eyes were wide and sightless. There was blood on her hands. Beside her, Her began to wail. The Tal Shiar officer said,
You can leave.
Get Tajuth here immediately.
Rafi, one arm still around Coley, nodded to Lieutenant Thakothrek.
Come here and look after her.
Thakothrek hurried around and Rafi hit her comm badge.
Tajuth, transporter room 2, now.
He was with them almost at once. He stood with his hands tucked behind his back, looking calmly back at them.
Lieutenant, said Picard. Did you request that the Tal Shiar be sent to Nimbus?
Tajuth blinked.
Admiral, I keep my superiors informed as to the progress of our mission. If, on reading my reports, they choose to intervene, that is their right as a sovereign...
Coley sank down on the transporter step and began to weep.
I swear, said Rafi, I am going to punch you out.
That would be a hostile act, Commander Musiker, said Tajuth. And yet one feels some sympathy with it, said Picard.
Why here? Why now?
You would have to ask my superiors. Very well, I shall. Meanwhile, in your capacity as liaison officer to those superiors, please give me your best assessment of the situation down on Nimbus.
Tajuth swallowed. A request for assistance, thought Rafi, was not what he had anticipated.
I am not sure, Tajuth said. Nimbus 3 has for the most part been left to its own devices for many years. Perhaps the relocation was taking too long. Somebody decided that they could be made an example of.
Coley, sitting nearby, said, I want to go back down.
Tajuth said, I don't think that will be permitted.
You'd better ask, said Picard softly.
Admiral, my superiors have been very clear. This particular relocation effort is now the direct responsibility of the Romulan government. And my understanding is that your superiors have been very clear to you, too.
There was a short silence.
J.L., said Rafi, there's going to be a massacre.
Admiral, please, said Coley. Tears were running down her face. Let me go back down there.
Picard looked at Tajuth. Slowly, he shook his head. We have direct orders from the CNC, he said.
He knelt down before her.
Jokan, I'm sorry. Our hands are tied. There's nothing we can do.
Rafi helped Coley back to her quarters. She suggested a sedative, but Coley refused. She watched as the Bajoran woman lit candles all around the room.
What are you doing, Jokan?
She was reminded of the gratitude ritual they had shared here with the Admiral all those long months ago, but she didn't think this was the same thing. Coley had a bright, almost feverish look to her eye, and she was whispering under her breath.
Jokan, are you okay?
I'm fine. I'm praying. This is what we always did after there was murder. When the Cardassians arrived and people were taken away, light a candle. Say a prayer. Wait for the prophets to remember us and dispense justice.
She looked at Rafi.
I told you and the Admiral what was going to happen. I won't forget this.
Rafi left her to it and went to join Picard in his ready room.
Are you sure there's nothing we can do, J.L.? Jokan is sure that there's going to be blood spilled.
We don't know that, Rafi, but Bordson insists. An intervention here would be a serious risk to the wider mission. Counselor Quest was embarrassed by Dr. Safadi at the committee. Tempers are running high.
You're kidding, right?
Rafi couldn't believe what she was hearing.
Some damn counselor from some stupid little border world didn't get her own way, and to make her feel better, we have to sit on our hands while the Tal Shiar murder helpless people?
We don't know, Picard insisted, that is going to happen. We do know that we have explicit orders from our CNC not to get involved.
I've seen you play pretty fast and loose with explicit orders in the past, J.L.
I don't think you have, Rafi, he said mildly. I think you've seen me play fast and loose with the discretion and authority granted me as an admiral.
There was a pause.
Sorry, sir.
I'm sorry too, Rafi. Nobody wants this. Nobody in their right mind, at least.
Except Tajuth.
Picard looked thoughtful.
I'm not even sure he wanted this either.
The Verity remained in orbit over Nimbus for the next 10 days, ostensibly to assist at any point in removing the population. No request came from the Romulan government for aid. 8 Romulan vessels were now in orbit over Nimbus, and exchanges between the two fleets had been terse and tense. On the 10th day, a communication arrived from the Romulans that the population was now settled on their ships and that they would shortly be on their way. They were asked to leave the system. Rafi stood on the bridge and watched as the Romulan ships departed. She saw Tajuth standing by and went over to him.
Satisfied? She said softly.
He turned to look at her.
Lives have been saved. Romulan sovereignty has been maintained. Yes, I'm satisfied. It is telling that you are not.
Tell me one thing. Did you call in the Tal Shiar?
He did not deign to reply. She looked back at the empty world.
Damn, she said. What a damned mess.
And yet the relocation has been successful, Commander Musiker.
Some definition of success. He moved away. Her comm badge chimed.
Rafi, said Picard, could you join me?
She turned from Tajuth and headed toward the ready room. Coley was in there, sitting in front of his desk, her hands twisting together in her lap.
Everything okay, JL?
I'm afraid not, Rafi. Jokan has handed in her resignation.
Rafi stared at the other woman in disbelief.
What? Why?
Her concerns over our handling of events on Nimbus 3.
Jokan, you were there! It was an impossible situation.
There was more we could have done.
We had direct orders, said Rafi,
which have been ignored before. These people, they were vulnerable, desperate.
We did everything we could, Jokan.
I don't believe we did, Rafi.
Her face was tear-stained.
We backed away at the first sign of trouble.
If we had intervened after that boy was shot, there would have been more deaths down there.
You think there weren't more deaths?
That blood isn't on our hands.
We did nothing. The Tal Shiar arrived, murdered someone in cold blood, and we retreated.
There was a short silence. Picard said,
I find it hard to disagree with what you say, Jokan. You have taught me that these missions are complicated, that there is never a right answer. We did what we could in a difficult situation, an explosive situation. Rafi is right. If we had intervened then, more people would have died.
How many people do you think died after we left?
He shook his head.
We don't know that happened, Jokan. We can't berate ourselves over hypotheticals.
These are not hypotheticals!
She reached into her pocket and threw a tricorder onto the table.
Look! Watch what's on there!
Rafi picked it up. She ran it around in her hands, turned it on, and set it to play. A small flickering image, recognizable as the ramshackle square of the main settlement on Nimbus, appeared. She could make out figures, nearly 50 people, hands on their heads. Then the shooting started. It didn't stop until everyone was lying on the ground, dead.
Mon Dieu, whispered Picard.
How did you get this, Cully?
Asked Rafi.
They knew down on Nimbus what was going to happen, she said. But they knew I was a friend. They found a way to send it to me. I told you this was going to happen.
Jokan, said Picard,
his hands held open, his face aghast.
You have chosen on many occasions to step beyond your authority, Admiral. What I cannot understand is why this was not one of those occasions.
He knew why. Because the loss of life would have been greater. But he knew that she did not want to hear this. He knew that in her eyes he was lessened by his decision, and that this disillusionment was no small part of her distress.
I told you this was going to happen, she said. This is why you have my resignation, Admiral.
10.
Admiral's Log. Coley Jokan has left the Verity, and is now, as I understand it, on her way back to Earth, where she has agreed to meet Captain Clancy and report on Nimbus 3. I understand the depth of Coley's feeling about what happened on Nimbus. The situation must have been a terrible reminder of what she witnessed during the Bajoran occupation. I have gone through the events on Nimbus numerous times, considering whether there was a point where we might have intervened, but I struggled to see what could have been done differently. Once the Tal Shiar were present and had assumed authority over the relocation effort on Nimbus, I believe that any direct intervention on our part might well have led to a loss of Starfleet personnel and ships. I know that this is little comfort to those who witnessed the massacre, those who lost people. It cannot bring back those who were murdered. But all my experience tells me that the death toll would have been greater had we chosen to escalate the situation. The people on Nimbus 3 clearly counted as nothing to the Tal Shiar, and I believe that they would have been prepared to obliterate the settlements there rather than countenance further disobedience. I remain at a loss as to why the Romulans chose this particular world at this particular time for this horrific show of strength. Ravi's reports from the people at Romulan Affairs can shed no light. If there were secret military bases or other facilities on Nimbus, then why were we permitted to proceed there in the first place? Rafi suggests that the branch of the Tal Shiar that gave us permission might not have been aware of these installations, and when those in the know were alerted to our presence, they came as quickly as they could. I find these Romulan rabbit holes deeply frustrating. Indeed, they make me increasingly angry. Time and resources, and most importantly, lives are being lost playing these spy games. It is unforgivable. It is not yet proven, either, who called for the Tal Shiar's assistance. Rafi and I believe that it was Tajuth, but we have no evidence. I should note, however, that Tajuth has recently received promotion to commander. One would like to think that this is a mere coincidence. One can hardly avoid thinking that it is not. When I reflect upon what happened on Nimbus, it is hard to see who has gained. Not Coley, resigning her commission. Not me or this mission, losing a dedicated member of staff. Not the Romulans, I must assume, who now face difficult questions from us, their allies in this crisis. And most certainly, not the people of Nimbus, some of whom have been murdered. I wonder, in the cold light of day, whether Tajuth truly considers the promotion worth the price. And I wonder, too, what kind of man he is, if he believes it is. Perhaps Rafi was right about him all along.
Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Kirsten Clancy watched with compassion as Coley Jokan took the seat opposite her. The Bajoran woman's hands were shaking as she picked up her glass of water.
Jokan, she said, I'm so sorry that this has happened.
Coley nodded.
To some extent I was expecting it, Coley said. But to be there, to see it happen, and for nobody to intervene.
There were tears in her eyes.
Admiral Picard, of all people!
Clancy sat and listened. If Coley could talk for a while, then she might begin to put some of the shock of this behind her. She might even be persuaded not to give up her commission. Clancy understood the woman's revulsion. But, from various reports, Clancy was struggling to see what else Picard could have done in the circumstances. Any intervention on his part might well have led to considerably more loss of life. For once, she thought, Picard had obeyed the orders of the CNC and understood that his decision would have consequences for the entire mission. Picard had acted for the good of the many. He had done, in fact, exactly what Clancy would have done.
I know how difficult it is to understand this from Earth, Coley was saying. I understand that. But this case was clear-cut. I said that there would be a massacre. And there was.
Are you sure, Coley? Clancy asked softly.
Coley looked at her in surprise.
What do you mean? You've seen the footage, haven't you?
Yes.
Then why would you—
Suddenly, Coley sat back in her chair. Realization was dawning on her face.
Oh, I see. I see what's going on now.
There's nothing going on, Jokan.
No, there'll be nothing at all. I see that now. No inquiry, no questions, no scrutiny. Those people have been massacred, and nothing will be done. Nobody held accountable.
I've read the reports, Clancy said firmly. Nobody did anything wrong. Correction. Nobody within Starfleet did anything wrong. And it's not within my remit to bring Romulan officers before a court-martial.
So that's it, said Coley. Finished,
as far as Starfleet is concerned.
By no means, said Clancy. I'll be talking to the Romulan ambassador later today.
I'm sure angry words will be exchanged on all sides.
Jokan, said Clancy, you are the one who has always argued that we need not to overstep our authority, that we must uphold Romulan self-determination.
As far as is reasonable, as far as is moral. They murdered people, Captain.
They looked at each across the desk, across the gulf. I can't do anything about that, Clancy said.
No,
said Coley.
I see that now.
She stood up.
I'm wasting my time here.
After she left, Clancy sat for a while rubbing her eyes. Then she went back to work. She tried to put Coley out of her mind. A half hour after Coley had left her office, Clancy's comm chimed. It was her aide-de-camp. Captain, you need to switch on the FNN cast right now. Clancy complied. And put her head in her hands. There, on the screen, for the whole Federation to see, was the footage from Nimbus. Grainy, frightening, and utterly savage. Her comm chimed again. I have Counselor Quest on the line, Captain.
I bet you do, muttered Clancy.
Starfleet Command, San Francisco, Earth. Whatever the Romulan government was paying Sulda, Clancy thought, it probably wasn't enough. Perhaps the promise not to summon her back to their homeworld was sufficient to ensure her loyalty. Whatever it was, the Romulan ambassador didn't blink when they played her the footage from Nimbus. Clancy had to avert her eyes at several points.
Ambassador, said Admiral Bordson, can you give us any explanation for this?
For the existence of faked footage attempting to discredit Romulan officers struggling to do their duty in difficult circumstances? I would suggest you approach your own intelligence agencies, Admiral. This lie would be in their interests, surely.
Clancy and Bordson exchanged a look. So this was how they had decided to play it.
You realize the difficulties this is causing us, said Clancy. I'm dealing with Federation Council members who want to know why Starfleet officers are being put into situations like these.
Personally, Clancy thought Quest had a damn nerve using that line, but she was not beyond using it herself.
Worse than that, it's hardening public opinion against the mission. There are polls showing that a substantial proportion of Federation citizens are now asking whether the mission should continue in its current form.
And damn Quest for that, too, she thought, putting out a poll with a question like that in it.
Yes, I've seen those polls, said Sulda. Her mouth pursed, as if the idea of forming policy based on the opinions of ordinary people was highly distasteful.
You neglect to mention something about them, Captain. That a growing number of people believe that Romulans are ungrateful. Ungrateful! It's an insult!
That is not official Federation policy, said Bordson.
But it is what people are saying.
He corrected himself.
Some people.
We have our own footage, said Sulda, pushing a small holo player across the desk. Here are some images from Dundut, where the people of Nimbus are being taken. See? Here is the town that is being prepared for them. The homes. The medical center. You may keep this, she said. Scrutinize it. Hand it over to your people in Romulan affairs. They'll struggle to find problems with it.
I imagine they will, said Bordson dryly.
And when you are content with it, said Sulda, you can broadcast this to your people, correcting the lies that have been propagated. I believe this is what is called responsible journalism.
With that, the ambassador rose from her seat. She gave a small bow that somehow managed to convey both courtesy and contempt, and swept out of the room. Clancy turned to Bordson almost admiringly.
The damn nerve. As if we'd ask the FNN to broadcast Romulan state propaganda. The absolute damn nerve!
Bordson picked up the holoplayer. Nevertheless, they will surely make this publicly available, and their denial that anything happened on Nimbus will be a matter of public record, too. Tell a lie often enough, someone will believe it.
It's worse than that, Kirsten. Tell a lie often enough, and it stands a good chance of becoming the truth.
Federation Council, Paris, Earth. Quest did not waste time ensuring that political capital was made from the events on Nimbus. She was due to speak to the Council, ostensibly to report on the work of her committee, but she knew this was the ideal time to get her voice heard by a wider audience. Taking her place at the lectern, she addressed the Council and the electors.
I was elected to serve the people of my homeworld, Estalon, and I am proud, privileged, and honored to be their representative. My priority is to act as their voice within the wider community of our great and diverse United Federation of Planets. We're a small world. We're not famous. We're not on a tourist stop. That's a shame, because the hiking and the cooking are outstanding. We're a good people. We're friendly. We're hospitable. We're community-minded. But we don't have a high public profile. We worry that we're not being heard. When I speak to folks back home, they ask me questions about the Council's priorities. How much do they think about small worlds like us? Do they only agree to projects that have a higher public profile? Take the Romulan relief effort. Somehow, this has become Starfleet's core mission. Somehow, a whole generation of Starfleet officers will come of age without the chance to explore space, discover new worlds and new life, broaden our horizons as a federation. Instead, their careers will be devoted to just this mission. I am not saying that we should not help. Nobody could look at the footage from places like Vashti and not see that we are doing fine work, important and compassionate work. Other places.
She drew the line at mentioning Nimbus 3 specifically, but everyone would understand.
Well, I wouldn't like to be the one having to make those decisions. I'm not saying that there aren't benefits for us from this mission. In particular, let me praise the work of our scientists, who for the past few years have been pushing boundaries. And then there's the technical ingenuity of our engineers on Mars, working to produce new starship designs. Most of all, let's not forget those geniuses at the Daystrom Institute. I've been to their labs there, and let me tell you that what they are doing is going to benefit every single person in the Federation. A synth in every home. It's amazing. We cannot think that we can do everything. There have to be limits to what we do, because we have many priorities. We need to be clear that when we offered aid to our Romulan neighbors, we did not intend that aid to come with any strings attached. We have to tread carefully. And so I come back to my work on the Oversight Committee, promising a fuller and closer scrutiny of all our rescue and resettlement programs. We must ensure that they are aligned with Federation interests. We must ensure that our people on the ground do not overstep their authority or interfere with domestic Romulan affairs. And most of all, we must ensure that our neighbors know that we have not come to take advantage of them in their hour of need.
She opened her hands, an open book gesture.
We are not conquerors.
Verity. Picard muted the sound.
Hey, said Raffi. I was listening to that.
I was barely able to hear the counselor over your commentary, Raffi.
Well, it's the same old bullshit, isn't it? Since Nimbus 3, she thinks she's got a mandate.
She's an elected member of the Federation Council, Picard said mildly. She does have a mandate.
He looked at his exo's frustrated face.
All we can do is keep going, he continued. Keep demonstrating through our actions that we are making a difference.
They both sat in silence, staring at the screen as Quest continued her speech. Her actions were getting increasingly urgent.
I wish Coley hadn't quit, said Rafi.
I wish for many things, said Picard softly.
Most of all, he wished he had understood the full extent of the threat that had been posed to the people of Nimbus 3.
You know, JL, Rafi said after a moment, you should go on the offensive. Take this game right back to the politicians.
In what way, Rafi?
Get out there. Talk about what we're doing. You're the public face of this mission. Everyone knows who you are, respects you.
Picard was shaking his head.
I can't, and I won't.
People would listen to you, that's all I'm saying. You've got gravitas.
I'm gratified by that, Rafi. But flattery will not work in this circumstance. It is not my job to stand up and make speeches.
A short interview would do a world of good.
The thought filled him with mild revulsion. His job was here, on the ship, at the head of this fleet. He was here to show the purpose of this mission, not to tell it.
It's not appropriate. Starfleet answers to the Federation Council. A response from me to Quest would be to dishonor my oath.
But if you won't make the case, Admiral, who will?
That's Bordson's job. The CNC is the place where the politics and Starfleet meet.
Rafi did not look entirely satisfied.
He will do the right thing, said Picard. We're lucky to have him, Rafi. Other CNCs would have buckled under the pressure much sooner. We've been given largely a free hand.
Rafi stood.
As long as he understands how difficult these people are making this for you, JL, as long as he stays on our side.
Verity. The events on Nimbus 3 and whether Tajuth played a part in it preyed on Picard's mind. He was acutely aware that he knew no more about Tajuth than from the day he had arrived on board 18 months ago. Cool and self-contained, Tajuth did not socialize with other members of the crew. Picard was aware that he had occasionally met Coley when they were both off duty. Not for the first time, Picard regretted Coley's departure, regretted the loss of the small acts of courage and honesty that had done so much for the mission. Now there was no real point of contact between the Starfleet officers on the Verity and the Romulan assigned to liaise with them. He would have to begin building trust all over again.
I must remember, Picard thought, that such trust is possible.
When the footage of the massacre had been revealed, he had gotten in touch with Zani. Her counsel, as ever, had brought him back to himself.
You are not responsible for the choices made by others, she had said. To attribute to oneself that power is to assume that you have the right to compel others. And that is to deceive yourself. Do not lie to yourself that you could have done more than you did.
Still, Coley held him responsible for what had happened on Nimbus, and it was difficult not to believe he was culpable in some way. He had been the senior Starfleet officer present, and people had died. No matter how often Rafi said, how often he told himself, that their withdrawal had prevented a widespread massacre, his actions had prevented the mission from coming under further threat. But he could not free himself of a sense of blame.
Did I save lives that day? Did I lose lives? When did this become a matter of addition, subtraction, profit and loss?
The door to his ready room chimed.
Enter,
he called, and watched as Tajuth came in, as cool and impenetrable as ever. Picard indicated that he should sit, and they studied each other carefully. Secrets and evasions. The Tal Shiar way.
Let me try absolute candor.
The methods used by the Tal Shiar on Nimbus 3 were unacceptable, said Picard,
and lifted his hand when Tajuth began what he assumed would be a denial that the people there had been Tal Shiar.
Unacceptable and unproductive. You can't kill the patient as part of the cure.
There was a pause.
Tajuth said,
Did you want me to respond to that?
I would prefer open dialogue with you, Commander, said Picard.
Open dialogue, murmured Tajuth. With Starfleet.
May I suggest, said Picard, that our old habits and instincts will not serve us in this situation. Only trust.
Trust.
Tajuth seemed to ponder the idea.
Lives were saved on Nimbus, Admiral. The only people who died were attempting to prevent the relocation from happening.
We would have persuaded them.
I do not believe that would have happened. We were hardly given the chance. You'd been there some time, Admiral, Tajuth said. There are other and worthier worlds than one inhabited by a bunch of criminals and bandits. No life is worthier than any other. No one is worthier than anyone else. Everyone is worthy of respect.
Tajuth smiled.
Fine words. But, as ever, Starfleet says one thing and does another. We asked you to stand aside and allow us to handle the situation on Nimbus the way we saw fit. And once again, we found that you do not believe that our requests are worthy of respect. Our authority should be undermined when it suits the Federation. You do not mean what you say at all.
People were murdered, Picard said.
More lives were saved than lost. Time and resources that were being wasted on a small colony that are now available to save others.
Picard said, that does not excuse what happened.
Admiral, this is the Romulan way. You cannot expect thousands of years of Romulan culture to bend to your will because one Starfleet admiral wants it to.
Not one admiral, Picard said. Many of us, including Lieutenant Coley.
He caught a flicker in Tajuth's eyes then. Yes, his instincts had been correct. Coley had made a connection there.
The methods that were used on Nimbus were not acceptable. They are not something Starfleet can be associated with.
Saving face, said Tajuth.
No, said Picard. Acting according to our values.
Let me try again, Tajuth said. Let me try to explain. To many Romulans, it seems as if Starfleet's intervention is conditional. That the aim is not simply to give aid when requested, but to undermine Romulan politics.
The Empire faces an unprecedented crisis that would undermine any political system, Picard pointed out.
And that process does not need outside help. This is what our people are coming to believe, that the aid the Federation gives depends upon changing our way of life, changing our culture. Do you understand, Admiral?
I understand that Romulan culture is not as monolithic as your leaders would have us believe.
Tajuth frowned.
In what way?
I've seen many different aspects of your culture now, Commander. If anything belies the notion that you are all alike, it is the Coat Milat.
Tajuth froze.
Damn, thought Picard.
That was a mistake.
Please, he said, let us put all this aside. Let us deal with the immediate issues, the need to help. Are you still willing to help me, Tajuth?
Tajuth looked back at him, almost sorrowfully, Picard thought.
I have always helped, he said. But this does not necessarily mean that I will act in a way that you want, Admiral. Romulus is not the Federation. You need to remember this. You need to respect this.
As Coley did.
Tajuth did not reply immediately.
We will all miss Lieutenant Coley, he said.
And Picard sensed genuine regret in his voice. He stood up.
She gave you good advice, Picard. Respect us. Respect our values. I wish she was still here to advise you.
Daystrom Institute, Okinawa, Earth. Later in life,
when time and change and entropy had taken away from him much that he held dear, Bruce Maddox would remember the early mornings with Agnes Girotti as among the happiest moments of his life. What made these memories most precious to him, he recollected, was that they were theirs and theirs alone. At his request, they were keeping their affair private. There were no longer questions of his role as her teacher. She had received her doctorate in robotics earlier in the year, but he did not want people to know that they were together. The time he spent with her was an escape from the world. They inhabited their own bubble, where he felt completely at ease. He sometimes thought of them as living inside a snow globe, protected from everything beyond the dome, safe inside their own fine and private place. Once, just once, she said to him, "Are you ashamed of me, Bruce?" "What? What do you mean?" She was sitting in the chair by the window wearing his robe. She looked young and vulnerable and sad. His heart went out to her. He thought she was lovely. "I guess maybe because you won't be seen with me?" He came and knelt down before her. He took her hands within his. "Aggie," he said, "you are my inspiration, my courage. I guess I don't want to share you." It seemed to convince her, or to satisfy her at least, and they went back to how it was. Her arriving under cover of darkness, leaving the apartment early and without him. In between, she was everything to him. He spent his days working on a project so far from everything that mattered to him that he felt disassociated from it. He went through the motions, a mechanical man, no less, answering questions, directing research, thinking through problems, keeping the synths rolling off the line. But a part of him remained aloof. Some small critical part had not malfunctioned, not that, but had detached itself from the world around him. Only Aggie kept him from sailing away for good. Late one night, they lay together in bed. The lamplight formed patterns on her pale skin. Gently, he mapped these with his fingertips. She shivered with pleasure. "I've been thinking," he said slowly. She froze beneath his touch. "Oh, God," she said. "That's usually the prelude to goodbye." "What?" He saw the fright in her eyes. She looked like a small creature cornered by the hunter. "Aggie, of course not. I mean, I've been thinking about work. I have some ideas." "Shit," she said, putting her head in her hands. "I thought you were finishing with me." "Whatever would make you think..." "No, it's me," she said. "Stupid me. Stupid Aggie." "Go on," she said. "I'm listening. Take me through it."
"It was something you said, of course. Well, it's always something you say, isn't it? But this was something specific. The first time we met."
She flushed. "Oh, God, I was starstruck. I was hoping you'd forgotten that."
He ran his hand along her arm. "I'll never forget meeting you."
"Charmer," she said. "Anyway, what did I say that was so inspirational? Amongst all the inspirational things that I must say all the time."
"You asked me if I'd thought about the capabilities of a single positronic neuron."
"Did I?" "Yes, I did. And did you, ever?"
"Yes, I have."
Beneath the covers, she dug into his leg with her toes. "Clever boy."
"Ow," he said.
"Well, some part of me has been thinking..." He drifted off into his thoughts. She poked her toes into him again. "Go on."
"Sung's work. It's in B4, he said. "We have the building blocks. I thought, what if I go back down, right to the very beginning, right to the building blocks? What do I have there? A few dozen neurons."
Her face puckered into a frown. She was adorable. "Is that all?"
"Uh-huh. So I thought, what can I do with that?"
"Not much, I guess.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? But I thought, no. I won't let them win. I won't let Quest and LaForge and everyone else get away with this.
Good for you, Bruce. This is what I've been saying to you all along.
I can't do much with one. I need more. So how about I clone them?
What?
He sat up, wrapped his arms around his legs. He could hear his ideas coming together as he described them. Fractal neuronic cloning, Aggie. It builds on what we've done with Mackenzie, but it builds on Soong's work, too. Do you see?
He reached for a pad, began to sketch his ideas out for her. One neuron. That's all they needed. And from that came everything else. As he ran her through it, he watched her face. He watched her lips move silently as she worked through his ideas for herself. He saw the moment when understanding dawned, when his ideas came to life in her eyes. He saw that she grasped what he meant. She was, she would always be, his most gifted student.
Bruce, this is it. This is really it.
Well, I think it could be.
You are a genius.
Could anyone ever tire of hearing that said?
There's a way to go yet, Aggie. A lot of work to be done.
She pulled him into an embrace.
You'll do it.
And there's synths to build still. All the work for Mars.
Who cares about Mars?
She held him as if he were the most precious thing in the world.
This is creating life.
Romulan Astrophysical Academy, Romulus. Some days, Nokum Vritet could persuade himself that everything was the same as ever. Some days, he was able to buy food and catch the tram that went straight to the academy. Some days, he would even be able to work at his desk all day without suffering a power cut and not have to retreat home, sitting huddled over his books with a solar lamp, until fear of that running down would make him turn it off and leave him sitting staring into darkness. Some mornings, he would not need to put on his face mask, and he could step outside and think, the pollution is better today. Some evenings, walking slowly home, he would look up and think, what beautiful colors. What a fine sunset. He would look at the sky and tell himself that he did not feel afraid. But the truth was that he felt afraid almost all of the time, and bewildered. He seemed to be caught between two worlds, one in which everything was continuing as it had throughout his whole life, and another in which a horror was hurtling toward him, a horror so vast, so unimaginable, that the simplest thing to do was ignore it, and carry on as best you could, pretending that everything was fine. He was used to this. Romulans were used to lying to each other and to themselves. But even so, he could not completely ignore what was going on around him. The food shortages, the blackouts, the hotter days, the odd skies, the whispers all around him, the imminent and rapidly approaching end. Some truths are simply too big to ignore. As a child, Vritet read voraciously, preferring a sensational kind of literature in which far-flung alien worlds were beset by terrible apocalypses, great wars, overwhelming floods, cruel invasions, devastating fires that could not be extinguished. His parents, used to their son's oddities, had humored him until he had started to have nightmares, and then the books were deleted, and he was instructed to focus on his studies. The cold stars and their steady rhythms had been a balm. But even the stars, it seemed to Vritet, had betrayed him. Everything he had expected was coming true. The accelerated changes in climate and temperature, the sense that the structures upon which his world depended were breaking down. His calculations, he knew, had been completely true. And yet nothing was happening. Or at least not that he could see. Some people had gone, that was true. A few senior administrators at the academy, a few politician friends of his family. But as far as Vritet could tell,
the life of the capital city was continuing as it had always done, or was trying to at least. Why was nothing happening? Why was nothing being done? He knew better than to ask. He did not want to hear from the Tal Shiar again. He assumed that next time they would not simply pay him a visit. They would want him to spend some time with them.